From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Who are these people, and why are they saying these things? In advance of next week's start of the Florida lawmaking session, we'll help you figure out what's going on.
And what we saw was that legislation was written in large part by lobbyists.
Also this week, whatever lawmakers do, the governor usually has the last word, sometimes well in advance.
If he's being handed the bill, he's already decided and probably already publicly announced that he's either going to veto it or sign it.
We'll also give you the lowdown on legislative committees and recall the contributions of a state lawmaker whose funeral took place today. I'm Tom Flanagan, online and on air. This is Capitol Report and your end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. So far, about 1,000 bills have been filed for consideration by lawmakers during the 2025 Florida legislative session that kicks off on Tuesday. Most of those bills have no chance of becoming law. The influence of political parties, powerful politicians, and lobbying impacts a bill's future long before it sees its first committee. In our series, Florida Legislature 101, A Quick Guide to the Process, Tristan Wood unpacks how that power plays out in the legislative session.
The most powerful people in the state's legislative branch are the Senate President and House Speaker. Both positions are elected on two-year terms by their chamber's members and are tasked with managing the chamber's operations, presiding over its meetings, and setting a tone for each session. They also usually champion a priority bill package each year on a policy area of particular interest to them. University of Central Florida political science professor Aubrey Jewett says if the leaders don't like a bill, they can just decide to not schedule it for a vote.
They do have the authority to actually run the House floor and the Senate floor, so when all the members are together debating and discussing bills, and so that gives them some authority because they can actually control the process when they're actually on the floor.
Other legislators with significant influence are committee chairs. Appointed by the chamber's leaders, they can also shut down bills, Jewett says.
Once a bill is introduced, if it's going to become a law, it's got to go through a committee where it's debated and discussed and potentially amended, and then it has to be voted out favorably by that committee. And so committee chairs, the biggest power they have is they decide the agenda for the committee. So if they're against a particular bill or set of bills, they just never bring them up on the committee. And if they're not brought up, then they can't be debated and discussed, and the bills just basically die in committee.
But elected officials aren't the only figures that have significant control over the legislative process. Barry University political science professor Sean Foreman says lobbyists employed by special interest groups and corporations play a large role in most political bodies. But he says that's especially true in Florida.
One reason is because of the term limits on the legislature. That's what the studies show, and we have seen over the 2 decades that we've had the term limits, that it actually strengthens lobbyists because they're the ones with more information and more connections when you have turnover in the offices. So term limits actually made lobbyists more powerful in Florida. Money talks in politics and elections, and we have very strong business-related groups that give money to the candidates.
But lobbyists' roles often go beyond just giving advice to the legislature. Longtime political reporter Jason Garcia of the Seeking Rents podcast says some lobbyists have been behind directly writing bills that help their industry. He points to a bill passed last year that he says was especially controversial.
A piece of legislation that essentially prohibits communities in Florida from helping workers, and helping workers in the sense of making sure that employers like farm workers and construction companies are providing basic heat stress protections to people working in, 100-degree heat, making sure that employers provide like things like clean drinking water, or making sure that government contractors pay a living wage.
Garcia says the law prohibits local governments from creating those requirements.
And what we saw was That legislation was written in large part by lobbyists, specifically lobbyists for the Florida Chamber of Commerce, the big business lobbying group that represents a bunch of ag companies and theme park companies and the largest companies in the state. And so what you find is lobbyists end up doing a lot of the work that you would normally expect to be done by legislators themselves.
For citizens looking to make their voices heard this legislative session, Garcia argues it's important they understand most decision-making from lawmakers doesn't happen in public.
There are so many decisions getting made behind the scenes, and that often what plays out in public in committee hearings and on the floor is orchestrated and scripted. And so it is important for people to realize that they need to engage as early as possible in this process, and they need to engage beyond just, appearing at committee meetings and stuff like that.
Another important player in how this session will play out is Governor Ron DeSantis. He can veto bills and veto items in the budget. Jewett thinks he has been more active than most previous governors in using that influence on the legislative process.
DeSantis in particular, he's been very powerful because he's been so popular amongst Republicans. He can threaten, or at least, even if he doesn't say it out loud, there's the threat that the governor, if you cross him or don't go along with him, that he might support someone else in a primary election, like if it's a Republican primary, and thus maybe you'll be out of a job if you go, disagree with him or don't go along with him.
But since DeSantis lost his 2024 bid for the Republican presidential nomination, legislative leaders in Florida have been more willing to stand up to him. It remains to be seen how Tallahassee's legislative power players will navigate that dynamic during this session. I'm Tristan Wood.
So where does the governor figure in all this? Rob Will takes a look at the often delicate dynamic between the legislative and executive branches in Tallahassee.
Remember the old Schoolhouse Rock song?
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm
if you do, you've already got a pretty good understanding of the basics. Bills start as ideas, become bills, are debated in committee, and if passed in both chambers, go on to the governor, and then, unless they're vetoed, finally become a law. But making it through that process, that's the complicated part.
So every year in Florida, thousands of bills are filed, but the reality is only a small fraction, sometimes just a couple hundred, actually make it past the finish line.
So far this year, more than 1,000 bills have been filed, and public affairs specialist and Florida State University professor Drew Pears says what makes one bill versus another move forward in the process can vary.
What makes those bills special revolves around a lot of different dynamics, from who's running the bill to what is the political climate to, what is the need?
Pierce says another factor is the influence of a new administration.
We've gotten a new president, and he's got new priorities. He won Florida in the country, and he's now looking at enacting his agenda, and it's clear that the legislature in Florida is looking at supporting that.
Earlier this year, the Florida legislature convened for a special session in response to President Donald Trump's new immigration policy.
The legislature has deemed it necessary to enhance the state's ability to coordinate with and assist the federal government in the implementation of President Trump's executive orders. And whereas the legislature has deemed it necessary to appropriate funds to ensure law enforcement has sufficient resources to uphold and enforce the rule of law and protect Floridians.
That's Senate Secretary Tracy Cantella reading the call for a recent special session. But when legislative ideas don't come from the president's agenda, where else do they come from? Sometimes it's students or community members. Often it's lobbyists or political organizations. And Pierce says,
a lot of these issues are discussed and debated by other states.
National organizations sometimes bring proposals to legislatures across the country, and different states end up passing the same law. One example is Marcy's Law, which is now part of Florida's Constitution. It creates a list of rights for crime victims, but it started as a bill considered by lawmakers. The measure first appeared in California. Years later, a nationwide campaign led several states, including Florida, to pass versions of the same bill. Pierce says often Florida is the first state to pass something, and other conservative states tend to follow suit.
Florida often leads the nation. We're one of the states that I feel like whenever we set the pace for what other states review, but also we look at other laws and see how that's working in different states.
Once a bill is written, it heads to committee. Not every bill is taken up for discussion, but the few that are will face vetting and debate by a panel of lawmakers, and typically members of the public are given the opportunity to share their views. If a bill passes through the full committee process, it gets a chance for discussion on the House and Senate floor, where an identical version of the same bill must receive a majority of the votes to pass on to the governor. According to former Deputy Director of External Affairs for the governor's office, Jimmy Hickey, the governor's decision to put pen to paper isn't made lightly.
You know, this entire time it's public. So the governor's got his eye on everything that's been submitted from the upcoming members. So I would say, you know, if he's being handed the bill, he's already decided and probably already publicly announced that he's either going to veto it or sign it.
The governor can sign the bill, allow it to become law without his signature, or veto the bill. A veto can be overturned by a two-thirds vote of both chambers. I'm Rob Wilkins.
He signed your bill, now you're a law.
Coming up on Capitol Report, as a citizen, how do you let lawmakers know what you want? We'll tell you how to go about doing that.
But try to reach out in a positive spirit and offer some suggestions and say, I'm writing to you about this.
We'll continue our special guide to the legislative session so you can keep up with who's doing what to whom in the course of the yearly lawmaking extravaganza that kicks off next week, and you'll get a quick primer on how the committee process works.
Each party decides which of their members goes to which committees.
Florida Dreamers could find an affordable path to higher education blocked as a result of one bill already filed in the legislature.
Those that cannot serve everyone who wishes to go to them, they no longer can accept illegal immigrants.
And we remember Geraldine Thompson, the Orlando lawmaker, for whom the preservation of history was a sacred duty.
She had four kids, myself, my sister, my brother, and the Wells built.
Our next behind-the-scenes look at the Florida legislature involves the various committees that lawmakers serve on. As we hear from Adrian Andrews, this is where much of the heavy lifting of the legislative process takes place.
In the weeks and months leading up to the official start of the legislative session, lawmakers have been meeting in committees. There are panels on agriculture, criminal justice, health policy.
There's the Budget Committee and the Commerce Committee and the Education and Employment Committee, Health and Human Services.
That's Andy Ballard. He's a political science professor at Florida State University. This year, the Senate has 26 committees. The House has even more.
There are meetings of all of the committees to sort of plan the legislation that they will work on during the session.
Ballard says legislative committees play an important role in the lawmaking process. The legislature uses committees, joint, select, and special, to identify which proposals lawmakers want to work on each year. They also vet and amend bills and ultimately send them on to the legislative chambers where they have a chance of becoming law. Ballard describes this way of doing things as a bargaining process.
Each party decides which of their members goes to which committees.
According to Ballard, lawmakers are generally appointed to these committees based on their party affiliation, personal preferences, or their work and education background. He says it's an important role to play.
Let's imagine what it would be like if you didn't have committees. Then you would have the entire body considering every bill. And that's just incredibly inefficient, right? So you want to have some sort of delegation, some sort of division of labor so that everybody's not dealing with every bill.
Ballard says it's also a powerful role to play, especially for the committee chairs, who are usually members of the party in charge. Right now in Florida, that's the Republican Party.
The membership from each of the chambers is skewed toward whoever has more members in that chamber. you know, whoever's in the majority. In the current legislature, what does that mean? It means that there are more Republicans than Democrats.
Not every bill gets looked at, and if a committee won't review a bill, that measure can't move forward in the process. That means chairs can stop a proposal from becoming law without that measure even getting a vote. Ballard says there are many reasons that could happen.
Either because it's something that people can't come to enough of an agreement on, or it could be something in terms of, well, you know, we really want to do a certain type of immigration reform, but that would mean that we wouldn't have money to fund a certain healthcare initiative that as a group we think is more important.
Ballard says for anyone who wants to know what the legislature is planning this year, looking at what bills and ideas lawmakers are discussing in committees is a good place to start. I'm Adrian Andrews.
Say you want to tell the Florida legislature something. It might be a bill you want them to support or oppose. It might be an issue you think is important and they're ignoring. But the process can be confusing, and you don't know where to start. So maybe we can help. As we air our Florida Legislature 101 series, think of it as a quick guide to the process, Margie Menzel has some tips from experts on how members of the public can make their voices heard.
Jane Johnson, Bill Montfort, and Karen Woodall all know the legislature well. Montfort is a former state senator. He's CEO of the Florida Association of District School Superintendents. Johnson is retired from decades of lobbying work, mostly on health and human services issues. Woodall is executive director of the Florida People's Advocacy Center, representing groups like the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. All three point to the legislative staff as the first point of contact. Montfort says if you want to be heard on an issue, forging a relationship with those staff members is crucial.
We should never underestimate their value. They are just absolutely wonderful and have a tremendous amount of power, especially when we have term limits. You know, when you have term limits, your staff and lobbyists, quite frankly, have a lot of power, a lot of information.
Woodall says lawmakers and their staffers need to know who you are, what you care about, and that they'll be hearing from you.
The staff are gatekeepers. They let you in or not. They deliver your message or not. And you need to respect them and know that they also have the ear of their member that they work for, and they can help you.
The House and Senate have directories for finding the lawmaker or committee you want, along with their current work and history. Go to those pages to find the staff contacts. Johnson thinks email is preferable to calling because the call volume can be really hard to manage. And she says before you reach out, think about who you're calling or emailing and what their workload looks like.
And a legislative aide they are drinking from a fire hose in the weeks leading up to legislative session and all through legislative session. So you don't want to take a lot of their time. Convey your message as quickly as possible.
Montfort also stresses brevity. Keep it brief and factual, he says, and show both sides, explaining why yours is the better way to vote.
Because, there's always both sides of the issue. I mean, if not, it wouldn't be up there anyway. Do your homework. You got to know your opponents out there, and you got to know that they are just as genuine as you are in terms of the issue.
Johnson recommends having your talking points written up before you make a call or write an email. She says not to attack or insult, because you could be poisoning the well for any ongoing relationship you might have with that person.
If it's something that you're really upset about, that's okay. That's good, because it motivated you to contact them. But try to reach out in a positive spirit and offer some suggestions and say, you know, I'm writing to you about this, and I have some concerns about that. I think there's another way we can go about this. Or I would like to share my personal perspective. You know, don't say, you guys don't know what you're doing up there in Tallahassee.
And Woodall says you don't just come to Tallahassee and walk into a committee meeting to speak without laying the groundwork.
It's really important to have talked with the legislator or the legislator staff before the committee meeting. You should have already been by I'm going to be speaking. Here's my concern. Give them a handout. This is who we are. This is who our organization is. It's that advocacy before the committee meetings that really can make a difference.
Given the Republican supermajority in Tallahassee, Woodall says, it may feel like the vote on many bills is predetermined. But there are other advantages to showing up.
You're not just talking to those legislators. You're talking to the public that might be watching it on the Florida channel. You're talking to the press that's in there listening. You're talking to the leadership who has people watching these meetings.
And remember, you may only get 30 seconds or a minute at the podium in a committee meeting. So be ready with your elevator speech. You may even get to use it in an elevator. I'm Margie Menzel.
A bill expected to receive a vote this legislative session would ban undocumented students from attending most Florida public universities and colleges. Central Florida Public Media's Danielle Pryor has more on the proposed legislation.
It's a rainy, cold January day, and Evelyn Rivera has met up to talk to me at Hope Community Center in Apopka, where she's a member of the board. She's a paralegal, a wife, a mom of three, and a college graduate. She also grew up undocumented.
Yeah, so my family and I, we're from Colombia, well, specifically my parents and myself. My sisters were actually born here in the U.S., so they are U.S. citizens. And I grew up here since I was 3 years old in the state of Florida. So I've been here for over 30 years now.
Rivera says Florida is the only home she's known. She says it wasn't even a question that she'd go to a Florida university, so she chose Seminole State College. Her associate degree was the first step on her path to becoming a paralegal.
It's been a door to opportunities. And I think the big thing back then was knowing that I was getting a degree. I was in a pathway to get an education.
But Rivera is concerned other students who are in a similar position now may not be able to achieve the same. Republican State Senator Randy Fine has filed a bill that would ban undocumented students from going to most Florida universities.
So today I've filed SB 244, which would add to the no in-state tuition for illegal immigrants, a requirement that says at Florida's highly competitive colleges and universities, aka those that cannot serve everyone who wishes to go to them, they no longer can accept illegal immigrants to attend at all.
The bill would apply to all undocumented students, including Dreamers, and it would ban these students from attending competitive schools like Seminole State College, the same one Rivera attended. Competitive schools accept less than 85% of applicants. Fine says he's worried that undocumented students are taking away seats from Americans. During a recent special legislative session, in-state tuition vouchers for undocumented students were discontinued. Now UCF professor Aubrey Jewett is worried about another possible barrier.
And wouldn't it be better for us as a society if we allowed people to fulfill their potential and get an education and be able to work better paying jobs and to be able to contribute more to society instead of potentially having low paying jobs, needing to be on welfare, needing to be on the SNAP program, needing to be on Medicaid?
Gabby Pacheco says undocumented students have made the state better by going to college. She works for the Dream.us, which helps undocumented people get scholarships. She says if Senator Fine's bill passes, undocumented young people won't leave Florida. They'll just drop out of high school.
We know 16, 17-year-olds, how they are, right? And they don't necessarily see the bigger picture of even how important a high school degree is. They're just going to say, I'm just going to go to work, right? And why should I dream and why should I have hopes for a better future?
Back at Hope Community Center, Evelyn Rivera says she thinks students will still keep trying to find programs that accept them, like she says she would have.
It's something that was always ingrained in me and my sister's education and the importance of that. And so I think it would be very difficult. I don't think I would move out of state because Florida really has been my home for so many years. So I think I would just have to keep finding a school, a program that would let me at least take one class at a time.
Supporters of Fine's bill say undocumented students could still attend a handful of less competitive schools in Florida, albeit at out-of-state rates, which can be four times higher. In Orlando, I'm Danielle Pryor.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Orlando Democratic Senator Geraldine Thompson, who died this month at age 76, was laid to rest today. Joe Burns reports Thompson had a unique role in preserving Central Florida's African-American history.
They had a black ward that was held in the boiler room. This is something that I heard before, many stories, a lot of hospitals.
A tour is underway at the Wells-Built Museum of African-American History and Culture in a historic brick hotel in downtown Orlando. The Wells-Built was founded in 2001 by Geraldine Thompson. She was a public school teacher and Valencia College administrator before founding the museum and being elected in 2006 to the Florida Legislature. In a quiet corner, Elizabeth Grace, the youngest of Thompson's three children, pauses to control her emotions as she talks about her mom's work.
I would often tease my mom and say that she had four kids, myself, my sister, my brother, and the Wells-Built.
Grace says Thompson taught her that African-American history is American history.
And to try to tell the story of America, or more specifically Central Florida, without telling the story of African-Americans is a disservice, and it is not true.
Thompson sought to celebrate the triumphs of that African-American community and to capture and convey the horrors of racial injustice, like the Ocoee Massacre in 1920, when a white mob burned homes and churches, killing an undetermined number of black residents. It started when two black men tried to vote. One of those men, July Perry, was lynched by the mob. Grace says Thompson saw the importance of remembering him.
Because we all enjoy here the right to vote. And he was a part of that, making sure that she had the right to vote, the right to run, the right to represent, and that her children had that same right.
Shante Barton Stubbs runs an after-school program not far from the Wells-Built. She says the historically black community of Paramore has changed radically in the past 10 years, and the children need the connection to their history. It was Thompson's life's work, she says,
to make sure that we are heard, we are understood, but most importantly, we know where we come from.
In an oral history with the University of Central Florida's Riches Digital Archiving Project, Thompson compared her mission to the story from Exodus of the Israelites fleeing Egypt and crossing the parted Red Sea. She said they were commanded to pick up stones and, on the far side, build a memorial.
That generations hence would pass the stones and ask, "What mean ye by these stones?" And they would be able to tell the story.
Thompson likewise collected stones, stories, documents, photographs, and treasured memorabilia from African-American families. She published them in a slim volume for the Black America series in 2003, and she filled the Wells-Built with that history. In the UCF interview, Thompson reflected on a bill she filed renaming a highway for July Perry.
That's kind of like, "What mean ye by these stones?" So that when young people pass by and they see the road marker, we can tell the story.
But Thompson said you can't tell the story if you don't know the history. I'm Joe Burns.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Rob Will, Danielle Pryor, and Joe Burns. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Evan Rossi, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Next week is the start of the lawmaking session, so beginning Tuesday, we'll upload our Capitol Report, the podcast shows every Monday through Thursday, and each Friday, we'll have our full half-hour Capitol Report program posted online and also broadcast on air on many of these Florida public radio stations.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.